We're talking about respite care for family caregivers who are looking after loved ones with chronic disabling health conditions. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Respite care provides short-term relief to a family caregiver who needs time off from caring for an ill or elderly loved one. There are more than a half million family caregivers in our state, and new funding in the state budget is directed toward their work. Have you had to take time off to care for a friend or family member? Did you get respite support? Was your employer supportive? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Lisa Schneider is Executive Director of Respite Care Association of Wisconsin, which is based in Appleton. Lisa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me today.
So tell us, what support exists for respite care in Wisconsin currently? What does the landscape look like?
Well, as you know, there's a lot of caregivers out there that are going unpaid that are currently being connected to programs that provide fiscal resources, but what we're lacking right now are the human resources to provide those said services. So it's really tough out there for caregivers to find respite care workers.
So how does that work then when someone needs respite care? Where do they turn to?
You know, that's hopefully where we're trying to spread the word about our organization, because there people don't know where to go to. Sometimes they will contact their counties. Sometimes they will contact the Aging and Disability Resource Centers. We're hoping to elevate our organization to be a central point of contact, basically for everything respite.
What are some of the common reasons that a person would need to have respite care? What does that circumstance look like?
Well, actually, we're hoping that people will take respite before there's any true need for it. So while we do help folks that are in a crisis situation, the whole idea is to really provide respite opportunities at regular intervals so that they don't get to the point of burnout.
And when you say burnout, are these family caregivers basically caring for an individual with a whole different range of illnesses and issues? What does the home life look like?
Well, it could definitely be a whole range of issues. I myself happen to be a mom to a 28-year-old daughter who lives at home with me who has disabilities. And so she is, you know, nonverbal and requires 24/7 care. There's a number of husbands or wives taking care of their spouses that are dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's. So we work with folks that are caring for people across the lifespan, from children all the way to seniors.
How has your personal situation and how that has changed over the years and the needs of your caregiving informed you about how you look at this issue?
Oh, it is such a personal issue and a passion, because I was fortunate enough to find somebody that provided respite, and I also found a provider agency that provided respite. And one, it allowed me to have a little bit of a life outside of my home, but it also, at least having some care opportunities out there, helped me stay in the workforce and be employed.
And so you found that support. Was it difficult over the years to be able to trust, to be able to walk away and say, this is going to be okay?
Oh, that's probably one of the biggest hurdles that people experience in regards to whether they're going to accept respite or not. I have had a respite care worker that has we've been connected with for over 8 years. And because my daughter had some behavioral issues, which is usually a big barrier to people staying connected with providing respite care for a person, the person I had worked for 2 years to get through and understand my daughter and her behaviors. And now we've had her for 8 years. So the last 6 years have been so rewarding that she just kind of put in her time to learn and understand my daughter, to now where things are just wonderful. So my trust level has just, I trust my caregiver complicitly.
Oh, wow. And so that has taken years, though, to develop the bonds and the understanding of your daughter's conditions.
It has. And it's taken a lot of dialogue between myself and my respite care worker, because she needs to understand what the needs, what Kelsey's needs are, and kind of a if this, then that, if you see this, because she's nonverbal. So I need to explain what that means. I need to explain different other indications, whether she's got to go to the bathroom or everybody has their own idiosyncrasies, and only the person who's providing the caregiving can communicate that to a respite care worker so that they can provide appropriate care.
We're talking about respite care here in Wisconsin for family caregivers. Lisa Schneider heads up the Respite Care Association of Wisconsin. You can join in. Are you a caregiver? What challenges do you face? What has improved over the years? And what questions or concerns do you have about state and federal support for caregiving? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Tom now, joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
I fully agree with this program, and I have seven brothers and sisters, and I took care of my mother. And the caregiver has to assert yourself, be forceful, ask your family for help, and get help other places, because you do need some time off to recharge your battery. And you'll go around feeling like the family patsy if you don't. You have to really stand up and ask for the help. And a lot of times, caregivers don't do it.
Tom, thank you for the call. But sometimes it can be hard, Lisa, to say, hey, I think I need some support. I need some help with this.
Oh, that's probably the hardest thing for people to, one, ask for help, and then, two, to accept the help. There's a sense of, this is my loved one. It's my responsibility to care for this person. And there's also a sense of guilt that comes along with accepting help. So that's some of the stuff that we're trying to overcome, those barriers through education and information to showcase the benefits that respite does have on caregivers.
Lisa, can you break down the new funding for us in the state budget? How much is being added, and how exactly will it be used?
Sure. Currently, we receive $225,000 annually, and it has been increased by $125,000. So we're looking to use those dollars. As you know, there's a workforce crisis out there. So we are trying to expand our existing online registry that has listings of trained respite care workers on there right now. We want to expand that to include respite care providers and agencies, and to use that as a tool to connect caregivers with workers, with providers, workers with provider agencies for employment, and provider agencies that are looking for workers. So it's going to hopefully be a matching system. We're also looking to expand our training of respite care workers and our recruitment of respite care workers by going throughout the state and casting a wide net, talking about what respite care is and the impact it has on caregivers' lives, and show some insight as to what respite really looks like in regards to providing care. And we're doing a lot of that with our online curriculum that people can take for free to learn just the core basics of providing care. But we're also increasing our collaborations with the likes of UW Oshkosh and UW-Madison School of Nursing.
Talking with Lisa Schneider, she heads up the Respite Care Association of Wisconsin. Are you a caregiver? What challenges do you face? What has improved over the years? What questions do you have about funding and the support that is out there? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute, more conversation here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about respite care funding here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Respite is temporary relief to caregivers from the ongoing responsibility of caring for people of all ages with special needs. There are about 43 million family caregivers nationwide, hundreds of thousands here in Wisconsin. We're learning about additional funding in the state budget designed to boost the services. Have you had an accident or illness that required help from your loved ones? Did you both feel properly supported financially? Are you a caregiver? What challenges do you face and what has improved? Join in at 800-642-1234. Lisa Schneider stays with us. She is Executive Director of Respite Care Association of Wisconsin. Lisa, you had mentioned this is the first time respite care funding has increased in 20 years in the state budget. So what is your perspective on why this has taken so long, really, to gain traction among lawmakers?
You know, I don't know the history of why it hasn't happened. I just know that I was able to work with colleagues and express the need to do so. And I think through effective communication and demonstration of the need, it happened.
You have said that respite care is the most misunderstood of support types. Help us understand that. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think, first of all, a lot of people, when you see the word respite, they're just not familiar with the word. And so to explain even simply what respite is, let alone what it can look like, the impact it has on their life, on their loved one's life, it's just really an incredible opening when people do finally understand the importance of it and the role that it has in their caregiving life.
Earlier this year, Governor Evers announced the creation of a task force on caregiving. What do you hope the governor and this task force will consider when it comes to this aspect of caregiving?
Well, I'm hoping it actually, when you look at the task force and what it's charged with, it ties in very well with a lot of the things that Respite Care Association of Wisconsin is working on. I am hoping, fingers crossed, for an appointment to that. I've applied. And I really hope that there are some solid recommendations in regards to addressing the care workforce crisis out there.
What is the crisis being caused by? I mean, what do you see is going on there?
Well, I think it's exponential. There could be, it's a number of reasons. One, it's a very low paying position right now. For most of the time, agencies are paid for with Medicaid waiver type dollars. The reimbursement rate is not meeting the needs of what agencies need to pay employees to stay with the program. There's a lot of training that the workers need to go through, a lot of responsibility, and it's just a lack of, there's other better job opportunities, to be honest.
There was a survey that went out, and it said 55% of Wisconsin's family caregivers reported being overwhelmed by the amount of care their family member needs. Can you tell us more about what this survey revealed?
If you're referring to the survey that we did through an alliance called the Wisconsin Family and Caregiver Support Alliance, we are really trying to see and understand what's happening in a caregiver's world, what's needed, and how can we best address their needs. And cross the comparatively speaking, we also surveyed professionals to see how familiar they are with the resources and the needs of family caregivers. And we're going to try to cross match those issues so that we can come out with some very strong recommended actions to take.
When we're talking about respite care, how much with, you know, when it is a family, perhaps they have a full-time caregiver at home, a family member, how much respite care would one need, or what is the hours ratio?
Well, for the most part, respite is actually meant to be for a break purpose and not necessarily for work purpose. So one, not only are there issues out there for finding just providing care during the day while you go to work, you're still not getting a break as a caregiver. So respite could range from, you know, having a couple hours a week to go for dinner, to go see a movie. It could be for a weekend or it can be for a week so you can go on vacation and celebrate an anniversary or something like that. So respite looks different for every caregiver, and the way that they use respite is different, just as diverse as anybody else.
Respite care funding is proposed to be increased at the federal level, and the lifespan respite care program was reauthorized at $20 million with increases of $10 million each year after 2024. What is your take on what's happening at the federal level?
Well, I'm very excited to see what's going on there. Wisconsin has applied for and received these federal dollars in the past. They haven't in the past couple years, and so the opening for these dollars only occurs every 3 years, and the next window is coming up for 2020. So we're hoping to get an application in there and bring some of these dollars to help work on expanding respite-related issues.
Yeah. What type of grants are being offered at the federal level through this respite care program?
Well, the respite care program is really meant to do outreach and, try to create a central focused place for people to go for everything respite. So there's a lot of other organizations like Respite Care of Wisconsin throughout the state. So there's 37 states that have people or organizations like ours. And then when they apply for these funds, we can use those funds to expand programming that we wouldn't normally be able to do with the budgets that we currently have. And it really helps set the stage to build upon. So it's something that you want it to be a sustainable effort that we can build upon with those dollars.
We're talking with Lisa Schneider about respite care here in Wisconsin for family caregivers, and she heads up the Respite Care Association of Wisconsin. You can join in 800-642-1234. Are you a caregiver? What does your situation look like? What challenges do you face on a daily basis? And how have things improved or not over the years? What questions or concerns do you have about state and federal support for caregiving? We're at 800-642-1234. 421234, email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa, respite care workers are those who provide relief of the caregiver, as we've been talking about, but how can people find respite care providers? What does that search entail?
Well, it's getting to know your, depending on if you're looking for support for either a child under 22 or under 18 or an adolescent, or and then for seniors. So there's different programs available, different funding sources. So you would either go to your local county or your local ADRC, and that would be a good starting point, at least for finding agencies. And then also, if it's just specific respite related, they can certainly contact our organization, and we are there to help.
And I was on your website. It looks like you really break things down in terms of what people can search for in with their particular situation on respite care.
Yes, that's our goal. Is information, in my mind, is a form of respite. Having peace of mind is a form of respite. Understanding how to navigate the system and knowing where to go is a form of respite.
Sometimes caregiving, because of a work or a living situation, is a long distance situation. What are some of those challenges out there in caregiving?
When we've done these caregiver listening sessions throughout the state, we hear a lot of these different stories where people who don't live with the person that they're providing care for, yet they're the primary caregiver to help this person at least stay in their home. Persons who have to travel sometimes out of state to take care of a parent, it's just finding the time and the transportation and the resources in a community that they don't live in.
Let's go to Tom now in Oshkosh with thoughts on this. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
My question is, are these services already being provided in Oshkosh in the Fox Valley, and how would individuals either find out more about becoming a service provider or accessing the services here?
Oh, well, again, that's the great thing about our organization is that we're a statewide organization. So we would definitely be an appropriate first call to make. We have information on respite-related resources throughout the state because we've got things at our fingertips. But we're out there looking to find workers to help train them. We're also providing information because there's just respite care provider agencies that are lacking workers, and we're trying to help them find workers. So depending on who you are caring for, again, and what the funding resources that you are using would determine if you would go to the county or the ADRC, or if you're simply wanting to find somebody, if you're already engaged with the waiver program, our online registry has a listing of trained respite care workers that you could find to see if there's a match.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Lisa Schneider is Executive Director of Respite Care Association of Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll learn about Madison School District that's trying to reduce its carbon footprint. Is your district using solar or wind power? Let's talk about it, 800-642-1234. We'll be back after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about schools moving toward renewable energy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this year, the Madison Metropolitan School Board adopted a resolution to use 100% renewable energy by 2040. Meanwhile, other districts are incorporating energy efficiencies. Verona's new high school includes geothermal heating. It includes sophisticated ventilation systems and LED lights. Their energy need is expected to be cut in half, and the school district expects to pay up the investment in less than 2 years. So how has your school turned to renewable energy? How have students been involved? Is it part of your curriculum to understand what energy usage looks like in the state and nation? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Jane McCurry is program manager of Renew Wisconsin. That's a nonprofit organization that promotes all forms of renewable energy here in Wisconsin. Jane, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So when you hear a business or a school say, hey, we're setting a goal of 100% renewable energy by X date, 2040, or 100% clean energy by 2040, what does that mean?
So that means that they want all of their energy use to come from renewable energy. So that means not using fossil fuels. If you look at schools, the most accessible forms of renewable energy are solar power and geothermal. So it's a really great idea for schools to set that goal because it means that they can start working toward having cleaner and healthier energy. Then they can teach their students about that energy as well.
We know solar, but what is geothermal energy?
So geothermal is using the earth to both heat and cool the air. So, you know, if you dig deep enough into the earth, it's at a very constant temperature. So basically, you're creating wells down to that level of the earth so that during the summer, you can put really hot air down in the earth and it cools it down and it can help you have more efficient air conditioning. Or you can put that really cold air down into the earth and make it a little bit warmer so you don't have to heat it as much in the winter.
Why would a school district want to change the way they use energy?
That's a great question. So changing from, you know, our traditional energy sources that typically come from fossil fuels over to renewable energy is a great choice for schools for a number of reasons. Number one is it makes a ton of financial sense. Schools can save a ton of money on their energy bills by switching to renewable energy. And then they're also contributing to a cleaner and healthier society, a cleaner and healthier community for their students. And they can create, you know, the brightest minds of the future with really clean, healthy energy that can go out and know how to be sustainable and, you know that their energy use makes a difference.
So you have your pulse on this around the state. What are some different examples that you're seeing of schools, you know, putting renewable energy into action?
That's a great question. I came with three examples that I wanted to share. So Oregon School District just got approval to build a new net zero energy elementary school. Net zero energy means that the school will produce enough electricity to actually power the entire school. So they won't need to import any energy into the school. They'll do that mostly through efficiency. They have some really innovative architecture that they're going to incorporate into the school so that it's going to be super efficient, use passive solar, which means that the windows will be placed exactly so that the sun can help heat the building in the winter. And they'll also have geothermal and solar.
Oh, literally, like, this is new construction
here.
And so the some of the decisions you make in the architectural mm-hmm. process actually will make this that mm-hmm. net zero.
Yes.
Wow. Yep.
So it'll be built with all of these super efficient design elements. It'll have geothermal and solar. So they'll be able to produce enough electricity to actually power the school right on site.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah. If we look at Madison College, they have the largest rooftop solar array in the whole state. So they're using tons of solar energy there. And then the Northland Pines School District has 331 kilowatts of solar energy spread out over two of their district buildings.
Where's Northland Pines?
That's a great question.
I mean to put you on the spot
there.
Carry
my Wisconsin geography isn't the best yet. but they're doing some really cool things. If you look at their school district website, they have a whole page that shows, you know, tells all about their solar array. You can actually click through and see real-time data about how much energy the solar array is producing. And so on that website, they say that they save almost $40,000 a year in energy costs and produce almost 20% of the energy that they need just from rooftop solar.
That's certainly sizable. I mean,
yeah.
that will take a chunk out of your budget. We're talking about school districts moving toward renewable energy, as we saw that Madison aims for 100% clean energy by 2040. Jane McCurry is program manager of Renew Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What steps is your school district taking to go toward clean energy? Are students involved in this process? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Jane, about a decade ago, the Wisconsin K-12 Energy Education Program at UW-Stevens Point, they did this survey to learn which schools have some type of renewable energy systems installed. And according to this survey, and there have been updates to it, at least 174 schools reported renewable energy systems to their buildings. Is that significant? Are you seeing steady progress in this as more schools get on board?
Yeah, absolutely. So not just in schools, but in buildings all over the state and the country. And the number one reason for that is because the cost of solar has decreased so much. We've seen about an 80% decrease in cost of a solar array over the past decade. So it's really becoming something that's very financially feasible. And it makes a lot of sense when you look at your bottom line to invest in renewable energy.
So is there a difference between renewable energy and clean energy? Is there a distinction between those terms?
You know, I like to think of clean energy as a little bit more holistic look. So at Renew Wisconsin, we work on all forms of renewable energy, from solar and wind to geothermal, hydropower, biogas, and also electric vehicles. So thinking about clean energy, I like to think of it as looking at all of our energy sources, from our electricity to the gasoline and natural gas that we use as well. Renewable energy is more specific to those actual energy production forms like solar and wind.
Yeah, because, I mean, some people would take issue saying that, you know what, natural gas isn't renewable, where that is still mm-hmm. a fossil fuel. So there might be, you know, there is that distinction there. You say that the cost is dropping and becoming more feasible for renewable energy. What kind of costs are school districts taking on in this area?
That's a good question. And it varies by project, excuse me. So renewable energy is a really great fit for schools because of the way that the school's budgets are sort of aligned. So schools have capital budgets, which they use to pay for buildings and, you know, large investments like renewable energy. And then they have their operating budgets, which they use to pay for teacher salaries, school programs, and energy bills. And often it's the operating budgets for schools that are restricted. And so they're trying to decrease their expenses in that operating budget. So clean energy is a really good fit because you can use a moderate capital investment to really supplement your operating budget. So it fits really well with the financial goals of school districts to make that investment from the capital budget in renewable energy.
And making the capital expenditure probably from the get-go, if you're building a new school mm-hmm. or if you've had some type of investment in the community where mm-hmm. you can kind of start from scratch and take in all of the latest and greatest, because right. I'm sure with renewable energy, the technology is always changing and innovating.
Yeah. And that's another reason that the costs have been going down is because the panels themselves are getting more and more efficient. So you can get a lot more electricity with less panels now than you could maybe 10 years ago and definitely 20 years ago. A little bit more on the financing. So if we look at this new Oregon school district school, they have estimated the costs of to construct and design the school to be a little bit higher than a traditional elementary school. But they'll make that back in, you know, just a few years based on their saved energy expenses.
And apparently energy expenses are the second highest cost for school districts when they, you know, in looking at their budget, mm-hmm. it goes personnel and then energy.
Mm-hmm.
So these campuses really take up a lot of fuel to keep them powered.
Yeah, so it's a really, really great investment.
So, there are so many things people can think of to pay for when it comes to schools. How do schools make the case that changing the way they use energy would be financially worthwhile?
That's a great question. I think it goes back to that budgets thing. So they're using that capital investment to supplement their operating budget. So it makes a lot of sense when they look at their financial goals. School districts also have gotten kind of creative with the way they finance these. So it's oftentimes not only school district funding that goes toward the project. In the case of the Northland Pines District, they actually accepted private investors. So they had private investors help them pay for the solar array. And then those investors make a little bit of those energy savings back. So it's a win-win for the investors, the school district, and their community. Also to help finance the upfront costs, there's plenty of incentives and rebates available in Wisconsin. We have the Focus on Energy statewide program. There's also the Cool Yard Solar Foundation Solar on Schools program that will help finance that upfront cost. You talked about KEEP earlier. They do tons of help with resources and education tools. And then if anyone wants to reach out to us at Renew Wisconsin, we can also help connect you with those resources.
So you're saying there are a lot of grant programs out there to get these school districts started. Have you seen any schools using their referendums, taking this to taxpayers and saying, look, you know, we need a referendum and hoping we can incorporate more renewable energy into the design of our school?
Yeah, I don't have any specific examples. I mm-hmm. believe that the Oregon School District did go through referendum. So the community said, hey, we really support this and support spending a little bit more on the upfront cost of the school. But I'm sure many school districts do use district or taxpayer money to fund their projects.
We're talking about school districts that use renewable energy to power their campuses. Jane McCurry is program manager at Renew Wisconsin. Does your school take steps to use less energy? When did the initiative start? What changes did your school make? And what do you think of the changes thus far? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your observations. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about school districts using renewable energy to power their campuses. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And there's been some traction on this. Last March, we saw hundreds of students walk out of class and march to the state capitol as part of the youth climate strike. Last fall, Wisconsin utility regulators awarded about $5 million in grants to help schools in northern Wisconsin reduce their energy consumption. And now Madison schools have this goal of 100% renewable energy by 2040. teachers, what do you think about schools adopting renewable energy? Do you think this can help educate the next generation about renewable energy? And students, what is your take on renewables? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jane McCurry is Program Manager of Renew Wisconsin. That's a nonprofit that promotes renewable energy, and she stays with us. Jane, how can using renewable energy act as a teaching tool for our students in the classroom?
That's a great question. A lot of these schools that have implemented renewable energy have boards up in the lobbies or a prominent hallway in the school, and so it can show real-time output of their renewable energy. So students, as they walk by, they can say, oh my gosh, look, our solar panels are creating electricity. And there's graphs and different sort of interactive tools that have been created so that you can really interact with what's seen as sort of a complex or data-driven, electricity seems sort of far away.
Right.
And this makes it very real for students, and they can really understand that, our rooftop is creating electricity that it turns on the light in my classroom, and that's amazing.
And they can also see the ebb and flow during the mm-hmm. day and in different seasons. It really becomes part of their life.
Yeah.
So what is, what would you say to a school that is considering some type of renewable energy, but, there just aren't the resources for it? Are there things that they can do with energy consumption just anyone can do on a daily basis?
Yeah, absolutely. And I always recommend that, if you're looking at your home or your business or in a school, you start with efficiency because that's the low-hanging fruit. So make sure that the lighting that you're using is efficient. Make sure that you understand your electricity use and can pinpoint the days of the week or the weeks of the year that you're using the most electricity and figure out why that is. And then you can pinpoint those certain appliances or days that maybe your use is a little bit high.
Oh, yeah, like during
that
a polar vortex.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. But maybe it's not. Maybe it's just some random day of the year or some random hour of the day that for some reason, your refrigerator kicked on when it shouldn't have. Or, weird things happen in your home or in your buildings. And so really understanding how you use electricity is the first step.
What is the significance of LED lights?
That's a great question. So lighting is sort of one of those low-hanging fruit things that people and businesses tend to tackle first. So there's a huge difference between using your traditional incandescent bulbs or upgrading to LED lighting. Typically, like with most efficiency products, the upfront cost is going to be higher to buy that efficient product, but it'll last so much longer and save you money over the lifetime of it. So lighting is a really good low-hanging fruit way for buildings to become more efficient and use less energy.
And then how do you determine a goal? Like how, districts have lots of competing interests. Mm-hmm. How do you get everyone on board and on the same mission?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's a lot about just, educating people about clean energy and the impact that it can have, both financially and in the health of a community. I know the city of Madison or the school district, they had a lot of parent groups that were very passionate about making this goal to go to 100% clean energy. So I think it means a lot when the parents of students get really engaged and say, this is really important to us. And I think there was a really large student group that had also said, we're the ones that are using this energy and spending all this time in the building, and it's really important to us too.
We're talking with Jane McCurry. She is Program Manager of Renew Wisconsin, and that's a nonprofit organization promoting all forms of renewable energy here in Wisconsin. We're looking at what school districts are doing to improve their efficiencies. Jane, you had mentioned earlier that there are resources, there are grants out there if schools, are trying to look for these energy options. Have the grants been increasing, and what are some things that school districts should look at first in terms of applying if they haven't applied for these before?
That's a good question. Yeah, so the Couliard Solar Foundation had just started their Solar on Schools program. If you Google that, you'll be able to find their website, and they do tons of work to put renewable energy all across the state. So that's a really great resource, and they have just been you know, investing tons of their money because they really believe that solar is the future of our energy production. And it's time for Wisconsin to get on board with that and make sure that we are, you know, powering our buildings with solar energy. Focus on Energy also has incentives and rebates available to all kinds of buildings in Wisconsin. So I'd really encourage people to check out those two resources.
What would you say to policymakers when it comes to energy in schools? What can we do at the lawmaker level in the legislature?
That's a great question. I am by no means a policy expert, but I'm learning every day in this role. So I think it's really important that legislators understand, you know, how Wisconsin is moving toward renewable energy and that it's really important to their constituents. So, you know, if renewable energy is important to you, I encourage you to reach out to your legislators. At Renew Wisconsin, we are in the Capitol pretty often talking to legislators. We are happy to, you know, make that connection for you or give you talking points. I think it's really important that we have education and we have engaged citizens out there ready to sort of, you know, fight the good fight when we need it for renewable energy.
When you look at all the options on the table with renewable energy for schools especially, is there anything that is you're watching that really excites you that looks super promising?
Yeah. So, you know, I did a little bit of research to prepare for this, and just all the schools in Wisconsin that have renewable energy already is super exciting. You know, you talked about over 100 schools already have solar, and that's just in our state of Wisconsin. That's pretty impressive. You know, solar hasn't been really mainstream for a long time. So to already have over 100 schools that have, you know, taken the plunge, gotten their community on board, shows that Wisconsin's really ready to be the renewable energy state, and especially in schools where, you know, our children are spending their time, I think it's really important.
Is there something you're seeing that is emerging that will be in the future down the ways, you know, in decades to come that schools should really be looking at and perhaps thinking about how to adopt?
Yeah. So, you know, I spend a lot of my time looking at electric vehicles. And so I think the next big thing for schools to think about is electric buses. Standing at a bus stop where you have a bus that's using diesel fuel, you know, just idling next to children, it's a really good opportunity to switch to cleaner energy, cleaner fuel that also really protects the health of the kids.
And these districts will have to, of course, upgrade or switch out their buses
yeah.
as the decades go by and the school buses need to retire. So mm-hmm. that is an opening to look at electric.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are there big cost differences there? Is it more expensive?
Yes, electric buses are quite a bit more expensive just because of the size of the batteries that you have to put in a bus. But again, you know, operating these buses costs half as much as operating a diesel bus, both in the fuel cost and in the maintenance cost. So it's an upfront investment that pays off over time.
As we look to start wrapping up here, we've been focused on school districts, but what do you see among communities around Wisconsin and the business realm of things? I mean, where are some of those really aha moments coming?
That's a good question. We see a very similar trajectory among households and businesses across the state where, you know, maybe 10 years ago, it was an idealistic vision to adopt 100% clean energy or to put solar panels up on your building. But now it's really realistic and feasible. And so all of the solar contractors that we know are just bursting at the seams. They're so busy. So, you know, there's just been tons and tons of adoption of renewable energy and clean energy in Wisconsin, and I just think it's going to continue to increase.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jane McCurry is Program Manager of Renew Wisconsin. That's a nonprofit organization promoting all forms of renewable energy in Wisconsin. And we've been talking about the Madison School District's plans to be completely reliant on renewable energy by 2040. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.